coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Who owns culture?
Wow, Mr. Kim, that's quite the get up.
Si, me and my señorita, Mrs. Akimi, to go to costume party.
Appa, what are you doing?
I'm a Mexican burrito.
Think you mean bandito.
Yeah, same, same.
Appa, you can't dress like that. It's cultural appropriation.
Okay. Cultural appropriation? It's just borrowing.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Why isn't the same true for culture?
You take my Korean dress for Halloween?
That's a cultural appropriation, Janet.
No, that's different. I'm Korean.
You were born in Canada. Our culture is not costume.
Oh, that's rich coming from a Korean guy dressed like a Mexican criminal.
How do we tell the difference between appreciation and appropriation?
Between exploration and exploitation.
Why are you so concerned about this?
I'll tell you why.
Who owns culture?
Because I believe Whatley converted to Judaism just for the jokes.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Can anyone own a culture?
When is it disrespectful to copy someone else's style?
How do you draw the line between appreciation and appropriation?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're asking, who owns culture?
Who owns culture? I feel like that's a weird way of thinking about the question, Ray. I mean, look, I understand how someone could own the rights to a particular song they wrote or something, but how could anyone own a whole culture?
Well, think about like the British Museum. It's full of artifacts that you Brits stole from other people all around the world. Don't you think that that's taking stuff that belongs to another culture?
Guilty as charged, Governor. I mean, yeah, okay, if you wander around the world nicking things and hiking them back to a museum in a different country, I personally think that is stealing. But mostly, when we talk about cultural appropriation, we're not talking about that. We're talking about borrowing an idea, and borrowing an idea isn't taking it away from someone.
Yeah, but it's still stealing. I mean, that's why we have copyright laws.
Well, okay, I'm not talking about plagiarism, like stealing a particular song or a book or something. I'm talking about a musical style. Like, what's wrong with getting inspired by rock or tango or reggae?
Okay, but what if, like, a white artist takes a style that was created by people of color and makes a bunch of money off of it and then doesn't give anything back to the people who originally invented it? How is that okay?
Well, that's not okay. But all I'm saying is I don't think all situations are like that. Just think about Paul Simon and his album Graceland, right? So he borrowed some South African musical styles. He even featured a South African band, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And yeah, he made a bunch of money. That's true. But so did they. And he kind of put their genre on the map for a lot of folks who didn't know about it beforehand.
Yeah, okay. So Graceland was a two-way cultural exchange. But what I'm complaining about is more like one-way taking. Like, what about all those cases where somebody just takes another culture's sacred objects and treats them like they're toys? Like when white women wear bindis as a fashion statement.
Yeah, that is kind of offensive. But I sort of wonder, even there, is it also harmful? I mean, look, it's harmful to steal artifacts. It's definitely harmful to profit from other people's work. But if somebody wears a bindi, isn't that basically a victimless crime?
Well, it's just disrespectful. I mean, that's somebody's religion. It's supposed to be special and sacred. If everybody wears a bindi, then it's going to lose some of that specialness.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you mean. And I think that could work for bindis. But I still feel like there's a lot of cases where cultural borrowing really is basically harmless.
Yeah, like what?
Well, a few years ago, there was this whole kerfuffle over hoop earrings, right? I mean, some folks were saying white women shouldn't wear hoop earrings because they're traditionally worn by people of color. I got to say that didn't really make sense to me. I mean, no culture owns the circle. It's a basic geometrical shape.
Okay, that one does seem a little overzealous. But cultural appropriation is a real problem. So what's wrong with being kind of on guard about it?
Well, the way I see it, one danger is it's going to stifle creativity. Salman Rushdie said it, I think, really nicely. Hybridity is how newness enters the world. And yeah, don't we want newness to enter the world? We want that kind of two-way exchange. It's how cultures evolve and grow and stay vibrant.
Yeah, okay. I see why you want that vibrancy and why stifling creativity is kind of bad. But if it helps us all get along, maybe it's still a price worth paying.
But that's the thing, Ray. I don't think it does help us all get along. It makes us scared to communicate with each other, so we all huddle in our separate cultural boxes for fear of offending anyone.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we really need some way of drawing the line between, like, what's offensive and what's harmful and what's, you know, just good old cultural exchange.
I agree. We really need some principles to guide us here, and hopefully our guest today can give us some. It's Dominic McIver-Lopez, author of a forthcoming book called Aesthetic Injustice that talks about cultural appropriation and other kinds of harm in the world of art.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to look into examples of white artists appropriating African-American music. She files this report.
Swing low, sweet chariot.
Is it really cultural appropriation if you just use your knowledge of another culture in your music composition? In 1892, the Czech composer Antonín Dvořák came to America to lead the new National Conservatory of Music in New York City. One of the burning questions facing classical music composers was how to express a national identity.
Dvořák famously said that African-American music needs to be this essential component in American national classical composition.
That's Douglas Shadle, a professor of musicology at the Vanderbilt School of Music. Dvorak told the New York Herald newspaper that in the, quote, Negro Melodies of America, he discovered all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. The New World Symphony premiered at Carnegie Hall the following year, and people had a lot of opinions.
It's really just funny to read the entire spread because some people say, oh, this is clearly heavily influenced by African-American music. And some people say, well, this just sounds Irish to me. And some people say, well, this just sounds Eastern European. And some people say, well, it could just be anything because it's so generic. It sounds like all folk music. And so no one really agrees on how the symphony actually sounds.
The piece may have included some references to black music, but at the end of the day, it still sounded European. Certain black musicians said it did not work.
Because you don't really understand what this music is, what it means, because you have not lived this life that I've lived.
Compare that to music by a black composer.
In America, the rise of jazz signified a shift in the American culture and music. One of those composers who helped with that shift was William Grant Still.
Here is Still's Afro-American Symphony of 1930.
I don't necessarily agree with Chuck D and his, you know, famous line. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me, yes, he's straight out racist. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant, you know, expletive to me, you know, straight up racist, him and John Wayne.
Emmett G. Price, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music, says in the debate around cultural appropriation, it matters how white musicians use their fame.
This is my biggest record, and it goes something like this.
In this scene from Baz Luhrmann's biopic Elvis, the king hangs out with B.B. King and sees Little Richard perform.
And he sings a hell out of that song. I would love to record that.
If you do, you'll make a whole lot more money than that kid could ever dream of.
Price says Elvis is a complicated situation. He grew up in a black neighborhood in Tupelo, Mississippi, raised musically on rhythm and blues and Pentecostal gospel.
Elvis used to sit in the back of the church at East Trigg Baptist Church where the Reverend W. Herbert Brewster was the pastor. And in that black Baptist church in Memphis, those brothers and sisters gave him absolute love, affirmation, and valued him, used to call him Brother Elvis, and treated him as since a surrogate family member. So did he have access to black people and black culture? Absolutely, there's no question about it.
Elvis's fame rose with the civil rights movement and he had a huge black fan base. But Price's question is, did he leverage his celebrity on behalf of the people who loved him and inspired his music?
When Elvis, you know, recorded Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog, You know, Big Mama Thornton, I mean, that he didn't write the song. And so how did he leverage his celebrity to help Big Mama Thornton come out of poverty? And the fact that he didn't do that is where we find the issue.
But Elvis was lost in his own narrative and didn't necessarily have the maturity to understand his own power. Then there was the racist and discriminatory music industry, eager to use him to sell black music to a white audience. Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker.
They are not putting a colored boy on the hayride.
That's the thing. He's white.
He's white? That's all on the mama
anyway, dude. When black folks turn the radio on, they didn't get to pick whose version of the song played. And so Elvis Presley's music played and was permeated across the radio waves.
To appropriate from the fictionalized movie version of B.B. King.
You don't do the business will do you.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that really interesting report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're asking, who owns culture?
We're joined now by Dominic McIver-Lopez. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia and author of Being for Beauty, Aesthetic Agency and Value, as well as the forthcoming book Aesthetic Injustice. Dom, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so pleased to be here.
So Dom, how did you first start getting interested in this topic?
Well, consider my surname. The McIvers are from a village off the northwest coast of Scotland, and the Lopezes from a village in southwest India. And throughout my life, I've sometimes felt pulled in different directions, and I've sometimes enjoyed opportunities to mix it up. So I can make a curry and wear my kilt at the same time. and I guess working in aesthetics, it was kind of inevitable that I would turn my mind to cultural contact, contact between different cultures. And how that can sometimes go well and sometimes go poorly. And it certainly goes poorly when cultural appropriation is a problem.
So, Dom, I see why that's got some kind of personal significance for you and probably for a lot of our listeners. And judging by how often debates about cultural appropriation are in the news, they've got personal significance for a lot of people. But what do you think is at stake in them, philosophically speaking?
Well, Josh and Ray had a lot to say about that. It set it up very nicely. Let me make it a bit of a puzzle. So here's a great thing about human beings. I think we are curious. We are migratory. We're magpies and recyclers. We reuse. So that there's that Rushdie quote, mélange, hodgepodge, a bit of this and a bit of that. That's how newness enters the world. That's absolutely right. We should embrace it. And yet at the same time, we know that our borrowings can cause harm. Now, that's a serious problem, and we need to address it. But at the same time, we can't address it in a way that has a chilling effect on the good kind of borrowing. And that means we need to understand what's really going on when things go wrong. And here I think that our understanding of what goes wrong is too simple. So if you Google around, people are concerned about property and permission. And they're concerned about giving offense. But I think that that really kicks the can down the road. It doesn't get at the heart of the matter.
So wait, what's wrong with saying you shouldn't steal stuff that doesn't belong to you? That seems like a perfectly sensible way of thinking about things, doesn't it?
Good. That is a perfectly sensible way of thinking about things. Things can be property, but property isn't a thing. Property is a system of rules for excluding from use. And that system of rules is supposed to serve a purpose. It's ultimately justified because it serves a purpose. So we have agricultural property to incentivize agriculture, feeding ourselves. We have intellectual property, theoretically, to incentivize creativity, pay people back for their new ideas. And so the question then is, what are the interests that are being addressed by cultural property? Sometimes those interests are being harmed, and that's where we have bad cultural appropriation. And sometimes they're not. So we need to get beyond, is it property, to what's the justification for the property? What are the values that are in play?
Right. So I guess if I were like certain kinds of Marxist or anarchist, I would think like all property is kind of nonsense. And then I wouldn't be able to complain about cultural appropriation, would I?
Oh, that's a problem for you, Marxist. And I don't know what to say about that, except that, you know, there's private property, there's common property, and there's the public domain. So private property is when I own something, I can exclude you from using it. Common property is the commons in the village that everybody could use to graze their livestock on. And that excluded people from using it in ways that prevented the community from being able to graze the livestock. And then there's public domain where anybody can do anything that they want. And really, maybe a way to think about it is, when should a bit of culture be public domain? When should it be common property? When should it be private property?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about cultural appropriation with Dominic McIver-Lopez from the University of British Columbia.
Do you feel protective of your cultural heritage? Have you drawn inspiration from other cultures? How do we draw the line between borrowing and stealing?
Owning, taking, and sharing, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Up the world every day, I'll vow that I must say I'm young, half black and proud.
Can you celebrate all your cultures, or do you have to choose one? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're asking, who owns culture? With Dominic McIver-Lopez, author of Aesthetic Injustice.
Have you got questions about cultural appropriation? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 550 episodes.
So, Dom, you were just asking a question. You know, when should a piece of culture be private property or common property or nobody's property? So how do we answer that question? How do we get some principles here?
Well, I think we need to understand what values are at stake. So what good is the bit of property doing for the community from which it originates? And I'm not convinced there's one simple answer, because we're talking about culture and cultures are diverse. That's the whole point, isn't it? And so they have different values. And that means we need to proceed on a case-by-case basis. Now, there might be some pretty general things that we can say, but we should be attentive to the particulars of the circumstances.
That seems fair, and it seems like there are different ways of doing things wrong, right? So we talked a little bit ago, Ray and I, about literal theft. You know, my fellow Brits wandering into countries are just saying, I'll have that, thank you very much. And then there's sort of the profiteering aspect, which we heard about in the Roving Philosophical Report. Then there's something like disrespect. So you think about, for example, you did the Atlanta Braves and their fan base and the cheers that they do. And then there's something like misrepresentation. So you think about blackface shows, which is a seriously disrespectful and demeaning misrepresentation. Are those the kinds of things you have in mind when you say, look, there are different kinds of values being served and therefore different kinds of, you know, ways of getting it wrong?
Yeah, so maybe we can articulate the values in a second, but let me just say something about property permission on the one hand and disrespect on the other. So we know this, that theft is worse when what's stolen means a lot to the owner. And we don't tend to pay enough attention to that when we're thinking about cultural appropriation. So that theft of the Benin bronzes from Nigeria is extremely serious because of their great value. It's not enough to say it's theft. We've got to say, you know, they are extremely important works of art. And international law just stops with its cultural property and doesn't talk about how some property matters more than other property. And the same goes for disrespect. So I think of disrespect, the kind of disrespect that we should be focusing on, is when somebody is cavalier about the values of somebody else. So there's been some press recently about people at music festivals who wear indigenous headdresses. So they're a little intoxicated and they're shirtless and they're rowdy. And in wearing the headdress, they're not paying any attention at all to what the headdress signifies for members of the home culture. You know, the headdress is a great honor and worn only on solemn occasions. And the folks at the music festival don't care about that. That's disrespectful. And the people from the home culture have a right to be offended there. But notice how here, again, we need to be open to the idea that the values can be great values or they can be small values. And how bad the cultural appropriation is depends on how big those values are, how meaningful the item or the idea is for the people in the home culture.
So I have a question actually about disrespect. The indigenous headdress example seems like one where, like, clearly people getting drunk and putting on this headdress are doing something wrong. But I kind of wonder about the general principle that we should respect sort of everybody else's ideas. Like, it seems to me that, like, some of the religious ideas that I grew up with were deserving of respect and some of them really weren't. Like, is it okay to criticize ideas and disrespect them as long as they're from my own culture? Like, how much cross-cultural dialogue should there be? And, like, how much respect do ideas deserve by default?
I love your question. I'm so happy you asked it. There's a big difference between aesthetic and artistic culture and other forms of culture. We can easily see that other people's art is great for them. We don't need to criticize it. I mean, if we're insiders enough, we learn enough, we might be able to say to an artist sometimes in another culture, you're trying to pull this thing off and you're not quite getting there. Here, I have some advice for you. So that might be criticism, taking the culture in its own terms. But we don't need to be down on other people's art or down on other people's aesthetic practices. We can just say, you know, it's all great. Isn't the world a wonderful place that we have all this good stuff in it? It's not like that with religion. It's not that like that with politics. Isn't it wonderful that it's like that for some areas of culture, like art and the aesthetic?
I mean, I really like the way you're talking about it. So picking up on the kinds of things that Anthony Appiah and Zadie Smith have been saying about, you know, thinking about this whole question in terms of ownership, that's probably not the right way to start, right? Appiah says, you know, if you think in terms of ownership, you've accepted a commercial system that's alien to the very traditions you're talking about. And Zadie Smith says that, you know, the idea of cultural ownership shares some DNA with the late capitalist concept of brand integrity. So you're saying, okay, look, let's not go there. Let's think about impact. Let's think about the actual negative effects of, for example, wearing certain kinds of clothing to a rave. But what happens when we get into these difficult cases? Like, so one of the most famous ones in recent years was a painting by Dana Schutz, Open Casket, which was a painting based on the photograph of Emmett Till after his death, after his murder, I should say. And this became controversial. Somebody, you know, Hannah Black attacked this painting in print, said it should be destroyed because this is a work by a white artist depicting black suffering. And that, you know, it was very controversial. You could sort of see arguments on both sides. But, you know, what should we say there? Because you could say, as some people did, damage is being done because I don't know. I mean, I suppose maybe it trivializes or something like that. But, you know, a lot of folks on the other side said, why on earth wouldn't as many people as possible shine a light onto the complicated and painful, destructive racial history of the United States? So what should we say about that?
Good. So I've been pushing back on the framing of the conversation around property, and I've been pushing back on the framing of the conversation around disrespect. I'm not saying property and disrespect don't matter. I'm just saying that they kick the can down the road. We really need to see what the values behind them. I also want to push back on a third element of the framing, which is the ethical framing. I'm not saying ethical doesn't matter, but it obscures what I think really does matter. So here's what I mean. We are nowadays worried about making mistakes. So you Google cultural appropriation and you immediately get guidance and advice on how not to be a bad person, right? And so get permission and don't be disrespectful. And that's good. That's nothing wrong with that. But the harms are not really, or they're rarely generated by single instances of appropriation. They're patterns of appropriative practices, especially on behalf of dominant or powerful cultures. Those patterns are harmful. It's not the individual instances that we should be focusing on. It's the patterns that we should be focusing on. And so it doesn't really help to focus too much on the case of Schutz, which is definitely a gray area, but it's also a single case. We need to be looking for the patterns. Of course, patterns of behavior are made up of a lot of individual behavior. So we should think about how we should act as individuals if we wish to change the pattern. But when we're thinking about what the harms are generated by patterns of behavior, not individual behaviors.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about cultural appropriation with Dominic McIver-Lopez from the University of British Columbia. And we have an email from Andreas in Germany. Andreas says, the one thing I don't understand about cultural appropriation is this. Why is it okay for people from other cultures to appropriate our quote-unquote white culture, wear clothes in the style we do, sing Western songs, play piano or orchestral music, whiten their faces, which is a large industry in Asia? To me, says Andreas, this suggests that there's nothing wrong with a cultural appropriation per se. It's always the context which determines if it's right or wrong. So what do you think, Dom?
Yeah, I think there's asymmetries. So let me give you an example. I'm going to give you a shout out to the work of Elizabeth Coleman here. She writes about cultural appropriation in Australia from Aboriginal people. And she makes a really interesting point. So we have highly sophisticated societies that are made up of institutions. And those institutions are created, they're shaped, and they're formed through various methods. For us, it's legal contracts and legislation. Legal contracts and legislation create our society. And she says, when we look at Aboriginal art and we see it as just something to be listened to, looked at, tap your foot, take some joy in, we're missing something very important. She thinks that Aboriginal songs and drawings are like our legal documents. They create Aboriginal society. So here's how this answers the emailer's question. It's obvious to everybody the value of the contracts and the legislation to create our society. We're the dominant culture, and nobody's going to miss that. Whereas Aboriginal people in Australia are not a dominant culture, and we consistently misunderstand the significance of what they do for themselves. And so we bumble, and we take their songs, and we say it's just like when they take our songs. But it's not, because we don't really understand what their songs are all about. We don't understand their social function. It's very different from the social function that music plays for us.
I really like that answer. I mean, partly because it thinks about dominance, not just in terms of political power, but in terms of aesthetic power, so to speak, right? But you still might worry that I think a lot of folks do think in terms of political power. And I think a lot of the intuitions circling around these questions of who is allowed to borrow from whom do seem to take the form of, well, you know, it's sort of you can punch up, right? You can borrow up, but you can't borrow down. But I've always wondered, are these vectors, these up and down vectors, as simple? This is almost a Foucauldian question, right? Are they so, you know, the wonderful music director of San Francisco Opera right now is Yoon Sung Kim. She grew up in South Korea. South Korea was not colonized by the United States. In fact, it was colonized by Japan. So what should we think about that? You know, Japan itself has been a colonial power. China is a colonial power. And yet we have these intuitions that it's not appropriate for Westerners to borrow certain cultural forms from Japan and from China. So is your answer something like, yeah, let's stop thinking in terms of geopolitical power and think instead in terms of understanding, right? It's cultural dominance, because the culturally dominant form is well understood. by many people, whereas the culturally non-dominant form is just not well understood. So don't borrow it if you're not in a position to understand. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. So the dominant folk aren't dominant in every respect. And the non-dominant folk, the disadvantaged folk, are not disadvantaged in every respect. They can have power. And so life is messy. It's wonderful that it's messy. We wouldn't want it any other way, but it makes us work hard, right? And so we look for rules of thumb. We want to take a shortcut. And so we want to say, if it's about property and it's taking from a disadvantaged folk, then don't do it. That actually cuts them off, right? Because you might lose opportunities for interaction and interchange. They might welcome that use of their culture. They might think that it's a wonderful thing, and it might float their boats. It might be good for them, and they might. So this goes back to what I said at the beginning. The real problem here is not to let our legitimate concerns about cultural appropriation have a chilling effect on the Rushdie point about how mélange, hodgepodge, a bit of this and a bit of that is how newness comes into the world.
Dominic, I want to ask about like a thread that came up in your discussion of like Aboriginal songs, which is like failure to understand what something is about. So it seems like one of the things that like makes me cringe most about stuff that I think is like appropriative in a way that I aesthetically really don't like is that it misses something about the source material that it's trying to draw from or imitate, and it misses something important. Like even if the person's heart is in the right place, it's still kind of unpleasant to watch. Like, so that's a problem. Like, to what extent is it a moral problem, and how do I think about that?
I'd like to, you know, maybe we should distinguish two cases here. So context matters. Say you're reading a novel and you're struggling with it. You go to Josh and Josh will tell you the context, and that will frame it for you, and you get it, and you get more from it than you would otherwise. That context matters. Sometimes decontextualizing can be a great thing. You take something out of context and you see it in a new way with fresh eyes. And that might be inspiring. It might inspire kind of creativity or inspire new readings, new performances. So decontextualizing can be a good thing. That's not always bad. So that's one case. The other case is where maybe it goes back to disrespect, where you're decontextualizing just as a result of not caring, like not giving a hoot about the home context. And that's a different matter. That's something that we should worry about. And again, maybe not so much on an individual case-by-case basis, but when the not caring is implemented over a whole society, that can be very harmful.
So I guess I was also curious about a third case where there's not just, or there might be caring, but there's not competence to understand what's going on. And so I feel like a lot of like, oh, these people are so noble, let me depict them kinds of cultural appropriation. Like the person cares in some sense, yeah. They've just messed it up.
Oh, I'm not sure. So I'm teaching logic and I'm imagining a student saying, I really care about logic, but I'm not going to do the homework. I'm not going to acquire the competence. It just seems to me that proves that they don't care.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking Who Owns Culture? With Dominic McIver-Lopez, author of Aesthetic Injustice.
Do you think museums should return artifacts to their original countries? Should we be policing each other's aesthetic choices? Or should we think of culture as something that belongs to everybody?
Making a mix without making a mess. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. Never even been through. If I think I understand just because I float too, that means I'm not keeping it true. I'm not keeping it true. If hip-hop started on a block you've never been to, is it okay to make that kind of music yourself? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Dominic McIver-Lopez from the University of British Columbia, and we're asking, who owns culture?
So, Dom, we've got a comment from Mel in Central California. Mel says, there's no culture that is itself not a product of prior appropriations. The cultures we see today are not somehow rooted in some God-created moment, but are the product of a swirling chaos of physical movements and edge effects. Do you think that's right, Dom?
Yeah, I think it's basically right. The only qualification I put on that is there have been relatively isolated cultures in the world. Alas, I think they're all extinct. But there have been isolated cultures who haven't had contact with other cultures. And we shouldn't forget that. But generally, that's true. I completely agree.
So we've talked a bit about how we want cultural exchange and to foster like communication among cultures, but we don't want people doing this sort of dodgy appropriation stuff. How do we strike that balance?
I'd like to hit two reset buttons. I want the whole conversation about cultural appropriation to be reset. So button number one is, it's not really about you. It's about us. It's not about how you act. It's about how we collectively act and how we collectively treat members of other cultures. Now, that does come down to individual behavior, but we shouldn't focus on ourselves. We should be thinking about policy. Now, the us there is at lots of different scales. So there's the national scale. So we might think about how we as a country should be organizing ourselves to treat other cultures better or to make sure that their interests are promoted as we engage with them and do that little bit and a little bit of that going. But there are other institutions, there are universities, and there are galleries, and there are orchestras, there are clubs, there are cities and communities, neighborhoods. There are even really large communities, like all the people who are tourists. So I want to make the point that it's not ultimately about individuals, it's about groups, and those groups exist at all kinds of levels. So we have lots of opportunities for thinking about how we should change our collective behaviors at those various levels. And the other reset button I'd like to hit is there's no silver bullet. It can't just be about, oh, cultural appropriation is taking property without permission. Therefore, if I have permission, it's okay. That doesn't follow because it's not ultimately about property. It's about the interests the property is supposed to protect. It can't just be about not wanting to give offense by being disrespectful, because disrespect is being cavalier about the values for the home culture. So we've got to understand and look at their values and try to get what they mean, what their culture means for those folks. And this is hard work. I know that we want silver bullets. We want simple solutions. But I don't think that it's going to work out that way. So I think we need a more nuanced conversation around cultural appropriation.
I really like that. And, you know, I wanted to propose, I don't know if this is a third button, but it goes along with what you were just saying about how difficult it is. There is no silver bullet. So my proposal is, you know, I want to borrow a baseball way of talking. Tie goes to the runner. Tie goes to the runner. There are a lot of gray area cases, a lot of difficult cases. Like we mentioned the Dana Schutz case. There's a lot of controversy about that. I personally think this is a very well-intentioned artist who said she wouldn't take any money for this painting. I think her heart was in the right place. She cared about a horrible thing that had happened in American history. Tie goes to the runner. That's my proposal. In cases where it's not obvious what to think, maybe we don't demonize the person who is ultimately trying to do a good thing. Then it doesn't have the chilling effect, right? So culture is allowed to evolve. It's good for art. So Native American writer Sterling Holy White Mountain said the appropriations critique is anti-art. That may be strong, but, you know, so, you know, if tie goes to the runner, it's good for culture. It's good for art. Maybe it's even good in general for this very conversation, because the weak cases risk bringing the whole idea into disrepute, right? We want to keep this notion of critique alive by strengthening, keeping the strong cases as strong as possible. I actually think it's also good for social justice because, you know, as Zadie Smith says, the notion of staying in your lane, that's not a great way of bringing people together. So what about that? Tie goes to the runner. Third button?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's a flip side of recognizing that this is a hard issue. When we're dealing with a hard issue, we cut each other slack. Mm-hmm. And a side effect of our wanting it to be simple is that we get on each other's cases too much. Right? And we should ease up a little bit. Now, I don't want to downplay how serious this is. I'm just trying to situate where the seriousness is and how we should deal with it effectively.
So One thing that you said earlier was that you were comparing sort of cultural appropriation to logic, in the sense that somebody who doesn't do their homework doesn't really care, or they do their homework. But I wonder if there's also a kind of nice comparison with how we treat errors. So if I'm doing a hard task, I should not expect to do it perfectly every time I attempt it. And like trying to have like artistic dialogue with people who are meaningfully different from me, like that's not a task that I'm going to do perfectly. I'm going to screw it up. Like, do you have thoughts on how to respond to each other as errors in a way that's kind but doesn't let anybody off the hook?
Yeah, I do now. You guys are shaping my thinking about this, deepening in some ways, which is wonderful. I'm so happy I'm doing the show. Once we recognize that a task is difficult, we should be okay with making errors. And once we recognize that the task is a collective task and it's not all on me and my own shoulders, then it's not so, doesn't matter so much if I sometimes mess up. And in addition to that, if I'm not sure, I can look around at what other people are trying to do, how they're trying to nudge our practices in a better direction. So I'm not on my own in trying to figure it out. I can turn to people of goodwill who are wrestling with the issue and are doing their homework. But maybe I don't have to do the homework. I can ask somebody who's done it already.
It seems like that's a recipe for a future of greater collaboration and a little bit more slack that we cut each other, which I think is lovely. While at the same time, being willing to, you know, die on the hill of, look, wearing this traditional headgear to a rave, that's just not okay. I'm sorry. That's just not so. You can hold the line on the cases that are clearly egregious, while saying, well, you know, it comes to this middle space, think about it systemically, and also cut each other a little slack. But I wanted to get back to something Ray was saying earlier, which is perhaps an even more utopian future possibility. Thinking, you know, from the, you know, Ray was saying, from the Marxist standpoint, all property is theft anyway. Even if we don't go to that extreme, there are spaces within our culture, like creative commons, we've talked about, jokes, memes, where people aren't really insisting on their intellectual property rights. In fact, if you create a meme, you kind of very much want other people to take it up and vary it and permute it and forget who you were. You forget the originator. Can you imagine something similar for cultural forms writ large, where we just kind of have that ethos of, look, don't steal my song, but if you get inspired by this style, that's great.
Interesting. Suppose that we continue to want to form communities. It's not adequate that we see ourselves simply as human. It's important to us that we have narrow identities of various kinds. They could be sexual identities, they could be ethnic identities and racial identities, various kinds of identities. Suppose that matters to us. Then how do we form those identities? It seems to me that aesthetic and artistic activity, they have traditionally functioned as mechanisms of identity formation. They're really good at that, partly because of what I said earlier on, having my artistic culture does not get in the way of you having yours, so it doesn't immediately put my identity in conflict with yours. That's good. That leaves me room to maneuver. So I find it hard to imagine us being the kind of people who form community, have identity communities, without marking those identity with hairstyles, dress, food, styles of imaging, styles of writing, the things that human beings have always done to shape identity.
This kind of makes me wonder if you can have identity without policing, which is always something I want. And never something I'm sure how to get. But it seems like one way to realize the utopia that Josh is talking about is to just imagine that like people will be drawn to whatever artistic forms they're drawn to, and that will be related to their identity formation. But there won't be rules about who is allowed to do which thing. They'll just kind of make choices that have centers of gravity.
Right. That's good. I think our identities are far more fluid than they used to be. And that, again, gives us room for maneuver. That seems to serve us really well. I know that there's anxiety in some parts of the world around the fluidity of identity. We don't necessarily inherit the identity of our parents, right? It's kind of up to us, and culture is always what we make of it, right? Culture is not a fixed thing; it changes, and so the culture that we use to shape our identity, that changes too. It's in our control, and that's why we're having this conversation. We want to keep it within our control, which means we do need other people not to use our culture that in a way that means we're no longer authors of our own destiny. That's cultural appropriation.
Well, Dom, that's a lovely place to stop a conversation that I would love to keep having all day. It has been fantastic to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you to all the listeners out there for tuning in.
Our guest has been Dominic McIver-Lopez, professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia and author of Aesthetic Injustice. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
I'm thinking that, like, one big piece of this puzzle that I'd like to see get more airtime is just paying attention to more authors and artistic creators who are different from you. Like, being an audience member is a great way to appreciate some art without appropriating it, because you're listening rather than speaking.
Yeah, and I liked your earlier point about homework, and it's such a fascinating, sometimes vexed, but beautiful and very complicated domain. And I got to say, hats off to Dom for an incredibly nuanced and careful, patient, and I think ultimately incredibly helpful effort to reset the conversation. I hope he is successful. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 550 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man who might take your culture, but he won't take your time, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, where would civilization be without cultural appropriation? We conquer people, take their stuff, then put it in a museum and let the world know we took it from people who couldn't appreciate it. Or make it our own. Next thing you know, white people are playing the banjo. It can work the other way. Black people saw Hawaiian slack guitar players at the Chicago World's Fair, and before I know it, bottleneck slide guitar. And Ry Cooter's got a shelf full of Grammys. The harmonica, developed by Hohner for German folk music, in the 20th century became a powerful tool for the blues that you could carry in your pocket. Get an optical illusion, add some immigrants with a gift for marketing, and next thing you know, you got a movie industry. Still around. Just the other day, the internet was up in arms because James Franco might play Fidel Castro in some movie. I sympathize with these arguments because I think Shakespeare's Othello is racist. Thoughts not diminished when I saw Olivier don blackface for the role. Nobody objected too much when Hamilton employed black actors to play white founding fathers, though. Conservatives were even thrilled because it seemed semi-reverent with hip-hop for the young people. You could perform it in high school. Even parents might like it. But there are limits. That's why we have culture wars. I get a little peeved at cisgen white guys for liking football way too much. It brings down the curve, but also white guys who buy season tickets to the opera. I have nothing against opera, but you don't have to go to every damn opera that comes down the pike. Cable channel A&E once stood for arts and entertainment. They would show operas. Nobody watched them, so now true crime and reality television, Duck Dynasty. The hidden life of a family grown rich making duck calls, luring waterfowl to their doom, making vegans weep, some of whom are performatively ethical white guys. All of this, more or less mainstream culture, is surprisingly fragile and constantly under siege. We love our cars, but did we have to become the kind of people who love cars before we could have them? Will we fall out of love, maybe? Once we go electric, we probably won't see Humvees in the road anymore. And are cars truly ours, or do they belong to the world? The rule of thumb regarding cultural appropriation is this. Pizzas belong to the world, but you don't have to feel guilty if you pick up some hummus from the cheese aisle. Your grocery store has a cheese aisle, doesn't it? Tacos are okay, but tapas require a license. Racism is slowly but surely disappearing, which makes some white people crazy. There's a belief that immigration is some kind of plot to replace white people with minorities. I don't know how that would even work. Would I have to leave if somebody from Bolivia suddenly showed up at my door? I also wonder about the habit on the news of saying so-and-so is the nth number black person to do a thing. I mean, if it's the first black woman to walk on the moon, yeah, milestone. Third black woman, same. 15th, though, 100th. At some point, seems to be the theory, whites will be in the minority, and a white person walking on the moon will once again be big news. So will walking on the moon be cultural appropriation? Cultural appropriation seems based on outrage. The thing happens. Somebody in a chat show responds. Somebody tweets about the chat show response. Next thing you know, politicians and their ilk, mainly. Also, influencers, commentators, are swarming all over Twitter and YouTube. They used to issue press releases, but now they make their own videos. TikTok dances. Angry in a way not entirely convincing. Recently, they're all angry about trans, who are apparently ruining culture with their non-binary antics. Trans is filling the outsider bill right now, but that can't last. Trans are just way too harmless. The worst fears seem to be drag queens reading fairy tales to toddlers and trans women wanting to play basketball. Really? Everything is a product, even outrage, and it belongs to us all. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Yi-Chi Shi, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 550 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.